It's really not considered to be the done thing to talk about money in polite society. But look, we do tend to think of ourselves as family here in Life Matters, so we are talking about money, specifically the touchy subject of inheritance. Do you expect an inheritance from your family? Or as a parent or older relative, are you planning to pass anything down? Have you received an inheritance? And if so, what impact has it had on your life? And more broadly, what are some of the big philosophical and ethical issues that are around inheritance? Is it a good thing? Does it contribute to inequality in society when inheritance is passed down the generations? Is there any argument for a return of so-called death taxes, taxing inheritance? Danielle Wood is an economist and a director at the Grattan Institute. And Danielle, first of all, what does the research show about how significant an inheritance can be for the financial security of those that get it?
Well, what the research shows is to date, inheritances in Australia have actually been relatively small. So most people that have inherited have received less than $50,000.
So a little windfall.
A little windfall, not a huge amount. What we expect, though, is going forward as we see older Australians accumulating quite large amounts of wealth, particularly anyone that's been in the property market since 1995 when we've had a house price boom, older Australians are now much wealthier than they've ever been. So we'd expect that inheritances are going to increase in size and prevalence. It also tends to go to people that are already quite wealthy.
Right. So if you're the small top bracket.
Exactly. Well, if you're in the sort of top 20% of households by wealth, you're 10 times more likely to get a big inheritance than someone in the bottom 20%.
Well, tell us a bit about the recent history of inheritance tax in Australia. First of all, when did these kinds of taxes end in this country?
So that happened in the 1970s. Geobjerg Pedersen, I believe, took away death duties in Queensland. That led to a bit of an influx of older Australians into that state. And then you get that sort of interstate competition. So the other states eventually then took away their death duties, and no government since then has been sort of brave enough to try and bring them back.
Well, Australia isn't the only country to do away with these, you know, so-called death duties. Why have they fallen out of favour with governments, though?
Well, I think there's two reasons. So one is, if we look around the world at countries that actually have them in place, they don't tend to raise a huge amount of revenue. Belgium is the country of the developed nations that's most dependent on inheritance tax revenue. That's still only 1.4% of their total tax take. On average, across OECD countries, it's 0.4% of taxes raised are through inheritance taxes. So it's not huge amounts of money.
Well, doesn't that depend on the rate, though, if you put them up?
It depends on the rate, but they're also quite difficult to enforce. So wealthy people tend to be quite good at avoiding them through things like family trusts or tax havens. So actually, they often end up hitting the middle class rather than the really wealthy. The other point, though, is they're just incredibly politically unpopular. People see it as their right. You know, they've earned this money. They want to pass it down to their children. So putting an inheritance tax on is often talked about as unfair. In fact, even poorer people, if you look at the survey data, are actually more likely to believe an inheritance tax is unfair than someone richer, even though they're less likely to be a beneficiary of a large inheritance.
Well, let's now also welcome Daniel Halliday. Daniel's a philosopher and he's the author of The Inheritance of Wealth, Justice, Equality and the Right to Bequeath. Now, Daniel, what role do you think inheritance has in contributing to equality or inequality?
Well, in the long run, inheritance can play quite a substantial role in contributing to inequality. Not just in a sheer inequality of wealth, but also inequality of opportunity. So we can talk about, you know, the wealth being transferred down the generations and some people coming to inherit while others don't. And that's significant. And it's particularly significant, by the way, if we want to make the distinction between, you know, inequality of income, wealth that people have accumulated through work, and sheer inequality of wealth, where people just get given money for nothing, for want of a better way of putting it.
Yeah, by dint of being in the right family.
Yeah. So we often, you know, the narratives often just talk about inequality, material inequality, as if it's just a quantitative thing. Some people have more or some people have less. But the reality is that, well, there are different kinds of material inequality from different sources. Some of these might be easier to justify from an ethical point of view than others. So what one view is that, look, if you've actually worked to create income and you've done so by making a contribution to society, then, you know, you got a larger entitlement to that wealth than someone who's just received the wealth really by doing nothing.
Sure.
And inheritance is much more like the second thing than the first thing.
Well, let's go back into history and talk about how this tradition of inheritance really took hold. Mm-hmm. What was entail and its purpose?
Entail was part of, it was a pillar of what we call feudalism in the pre-industrial age, particularly in Western Europe, countries like France and Britain. And what entail was, it was a way of preserving the aristocracy. And it might have been a good idea, by the way, to have an aristocracy, because in medieval times, you didn't want the monarch just going around calling all the shots. And indeed, the Magna Carta, is about having an aristocracy. You can say, well, hang on a minute to the monarch, you can't just do what you like. Now, in order for the aristocracy to be a kind of check on monarchical power, they had to have wealth. They had to be able to, you know, raise an army, perhaps, if the monarch got out of control. How did they do that? Well, by having laws that stopped aristocratic wealth from being spread around. So entail was really about preventing the fragmentation of wealth through inheritance. So generally speaking, the wealth had to go to the eldest son or the eldest male heir. And this is what, you know, this is what comes up in Pride and Prejudice and things like that, right? But of course, entail, once the Industrial Revolution happened, you didn't really need to rely on the aristocracy to keep the monarch in check, right? We had parliamentary democracies in Western Europe emerging at this time. And so entail started to look like a real relic. And so theorists, political philosophers, started to argue, look, it's time to do away with this, or at least time to reform inheritance.
All right. Just before we get onto that too, it's a point worth making, and you've mentioned, you know, how it comes up in novels like Pride and Prejudice, that that history of inheritance is, it favours one gender.
Sure does, yes. Yes, it does. It favoured one gender, favoured one social class as well over the masses. And most of the theorists writing in the 18th century, 19th century were men, and they were perhaps... Yeah, the gender thing wasn't necessarily at the forefront of their mind, although there were a couple of exceptions. Really, the idea at the time was that, well, look, we've got all these peasants working the land, but the land's owned by the landlord, by the aristocrat. These peasants have got no incentive to grow enough food because they don't own the output. If they owned their land, they would grow more food, it would have fewer famines, we'd have a more prosperous society.
So that's when unfettered inheritance starts really getting questioned.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, all right. Well, look, let's come into the here and now, Daniel. You argue that it might actually be time in Australia to return to some kind of system of inheritance tax.
Yes.
Now, why?
Why? Well, bearing in mind that the status quo is basically one of zero inheritance tax. I mean, there are things like capital gains tax that sometimes kick in to affect inheritance, although sometimes kick in when there is no inheritance. But really, and Danielle may be able to comment on this as well, I would think, but the 20th century was a century of fast growth, including wage growth. And during the 20th century, we became, I hesitate to say addicted, but we became dependent on income taxes and sales taxes. We're now looking at, a lot of economists believe, we're now looking at an era of slower growth. Right, and there's evidence for this. You know, wages are stagnating, housing is getting expensive in ways that are, you know, moving away from what people can afford if they rely on wages alone. And so inheritance is becoming this more decisive thing than perhaps it was in the 1960s, 1970s, right? For Australians and for other, you know, North Atlantic countries. So really, we want to get onto an inheritance tax. Partly, this is my view, I think we want to relieve the burden on people paying income tax somewhat.
Well, inherited wealth is the subject of this discussion here in Life Matters with Daniel Halliday, who as a philosopher has been considering all this, and also with Danielle Wood, who's an economist at the Grattan Institute. So, Danielle, your thoughts on inheritance tax, bringing it back, given what Daniel's just said about some of the reasons why he thinks it's worth considering?
I, you know, absolutely agree with all the reasons Daniel gave. I mean, economists tend to like inheritance taxes. They're quite efficient taxes. We like them more than income taxes because they're not reducing people's incentive to work in the same way. They also obviously play a role in reducing inequality. So there's a lot of benefits to inheritance taxes. The downside is, you know, what I mentioned before, is that they tend not to be that successful at raising revenue. So if you have a lot of people avoiding the tax, that gives you less scope to then use that revenue to do things like reducing income taxes.
So just let's consider, Danielle, a bit more the research you've done looking at inequality between generations in Australia. How much has the property boom in this country contributed to this?
It's played a huge role. So if we look at patterns of wealth accumulation, if you're someone, say, in the group 55 to 64-year-olds, you're now about $350,000 richer than a household in that same age group was 12 years ago. On the other hand, if you're a 25 to 34-year-old, you're barely richer than someone in that same age group over the same period. So we have a world where older households are accumulating wealth much, much faster than young households, and that is really to do with the property market. As I said, sort of property prices really took off relative to incomes in about the mid-1990s. So if you owned a house before that time, you've had a huge windfall gain. Younger people now, as we know, have much, much lower home ownership rates. They're struggling to get into the market. The ones that have got into the market tend to do so on the back of very large mortgages, so they're very exposed to increases in interest rates. So that's played a huge role in kind of opening up a generational wealth divide that wasn't there in the past.
And Daniel, this is part of your argument for rethinking death duties, a reintroduction of inheritance tax.
Yes, very much. And just to pick up on this revenue point, I mean, yes, I'm happy to defer to the facts about, you know, the revenue potential or lack of an inheritance tax. But we also, compatible with that observation, is that we want to put the brakes on dynastic unfairness. We want to put the brakes on, well, really a return to conditions of the feudal era, where you've got, your class position, the kind of family you're born into, really just dictates the kind of opportunities you're going to have in life. Now, we're not quite at the medieval stage by any means, but we are moving in that direction. We are moving in a direction whereby, look, if you don't inherit, you can't catch up with those who do.
So you're predicting a new Dark Ages.
Well, I wouldn't quite go that far, but we are moving. Well, here's some evidence, for example. Now, we've talked about the houses thing. You can't afford a house. You struggle to get a mortgage without taking on big debt if you don't inherit. You know, young people, like the students I teach, a lot of them are looking at doing internships to get ahead in the labour market. Now, internships are by definition unpaid. So who can afford to do them? Well, typically, the students who come from families who can keep putting food on their table, even though they're 21, 22. And that's unfair. It's not only unfair, it's probably inefficient from the employer's point of view, that the pool of interns are drawn from the privileged class of students. And we should care about this. Even if taxation doesn't generate revenue, we should look to it as a device for making society fairer.
Well, the idea that some people have considered in the past, Daniel, is that inheritance, when it goes to the first generation, shouldn't be taxed. But then if it rolls down the generations, second, third generations and so forth, it should be taxed to limit the sort of entrenched privilege you're talking about. Is there any merit to that?
I think there is. It's a difficult idea to fully operationalise and make precise. But, I mean, we can start making it look attractive, I think, by noticing that the prevailing political narratives against an inheritance tax systematically represent it as a tax on newly produced wealth. So you'll hear politicians, particularly in the United Kingdom and the United States, where the tax isn't quite dead yet, saying things like, oh, if you've worked hard, if you've saved and you've grown up a fortune from nearly nothing, it's wrong if you can't pass it on. Now, maybe that's plausible and people find that idea attractive, but it conceals the fact that a lot of inheritance isn't newly produced wealth, particularly in countries like Britain, right? It's been bouncing down the generations for yonks, right? And so from a point of view of fairness, if we could say, well, okay, if you're bequeathing or transferring newly produced wealth, yeah, maybe we let that through at a low rate of taxation, maybe even zero taxation. But if you're just passing on what's already been passed to you by someone else, then maybe we take a different view. And if we want to fight long-run dynastic inequality, I think there's a case for making that distinction. There are some other reasons too. You mentioned that the idea was popular in the past. It was actually quite popular in the early 20th century. And in those times, people thought, well, this distinction between taxing old and new money was actually an incentives thing. Because the person who inherits has a disincentive to work.
They can, the classic case is the English aristocrat frittering away the family money on gambling and other dissolute forms of living.
Yeah, and the idea was that, look, if you inherit and you want to pass something on, you've got to expand the wealth that you've received. Whereas just taxing inheritance by its sheer size doesn't really look at that.
All right. So that's the philosophical position. Danielle, what's the position of an economist? What are your thoughts on taxing along those lines? Not the first generation that receives an inheritance, but the second, third and so forth. Would that be workable?
Look, I think it's a really interesting concept. My key concern is workability. I can imagine there's probably a few people from the tax office with their head in their hand listening to that. I mean, so the challenge would obviously be, you know, if you pass it down once, then you're not getting taxed. That means they need to trace that well. So it's potentially maintaining tax records over many, many decades.
Yes, and so distinguishing what's inherited wealth from other monies you might have.
Exactly. And then there's obviously challenges if, you know, households break up after an inheritance. You know, does that money track with the individual or does it go across the household? So there's all sorts of, I think, administrative difficulties with that approach. The other thing I would say is it makes sense to me when you're talking about large wealth transfers over multiple generations. If you're talking about smaller inheritances, which is, you know, what most of us will be receiving, $50,000, you know, passed from one generation, should that family be then able to pass on the $50,000 to the next generation without a high tax burden? Probably, yes. So I think that maybe the size of the inheritance matters more rather than the kind of intergenerational
picture. Certainly, you could build in a threshold, but it is interesting to think about those things. And you know, if we as a society want to make any of this happen, anything happen, the administrative trickiness of it can be overcome, I guess. Danielle Wood is an economist. She's the budget policy and institutions program director at the Grattan Institute. And Daniel Halliday is the author of The Inheritance of Wealth. He's a philosopher at the University of Melbourne. And Danielle and Daniel, Dan and Dan, it's good to have a conversation about all this. Very interesting. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us on.
I'm Amanda Smith. You're listening to Life Matters.